And thank you for being here for week three of our three-part series. I would love to say I could add a session next week because there's a lot that we're not going to get to. But next week is Erev Tisha B'Av, the day before Tisha B'Av, and I'm unfortunately going to have other things going on. It looks like on that day. I will wish everybody a Chodesh Tov, a good month. Granted that the month of Av is traditionally a month of mourning for us. It's not a good month. Those who can see, I've got my scruff here because this is a period when we don't shave as well. It's a period of mourning for the destruction of the Bate Mikdash, the temples in Jerusalem. Nonetheless, we have our hope and prayer that this will turn into a time of joy and a time of celebration. Our class for today is dedicated, you can see it at the top of your source sheet, in loving memory of Dr. Aaron Weisblatt, Zichrona Livracha, by his family on the occasion of his first Yahrzeit. So thank you for dedicating it, and he should benefit from the learning that we do today. All right. Oh, one other note. I sent out a flyer last week with tentative dates and topics for the Wednesday classes for the coming week. So you'll be glad to know I actually have a complete flyer now because there were two more series that are added. So I expect to send that out to you when I send out the follow-up from today's class. So at that point, you'll have the full roster of classes starting in September and running through April or May. And then we'll adjust, hopefully actually get to meet in person at some point. That will be wonderful. Right now, they're on Zoom by default. Okay, so we are on the topic of the 16th century publishing war. We began talking about this last week. I brought for you on the sheet the first source, which we read last week, about just how bizarre this is. A dispute between two printers, neither of whom are Jewish, about printing a work of law written by Rabbi Moses Maimonides and with a commentary by Rabbi Meir Katzenellenbogen of Padua. I hope that I'm audible to you. There's some noise in the background from the air conditioning unit here at school, but that's going to go on and off, and there's zero I can do about it. So it is what it is. If you look on your sheet at source number two, we introduced the first couple of names last time. Daniel Bamberg, a non-Jewish publisher who is the producer of, as I wrote there, the first edition and the first and second edition, in truth, of the Mikraot Gedolot, classic edition of the Chumash, of the Bible with its commentaries, an edition that is still printed and reprinted and redone today, as well as the first edition of the Talmud in print as opposed to in manuscript. Bamberg is relatively old by the time we get to this point in our story. He is the king of Jewish publishing in Italy at this point, based in Venice. And then you get Marc Antonio Giustiniani, who is an upstart, also not Jewish, wants to undercut Bamberg on cost and pricing. And he says, I'm going to print the best manuscripts. They're going to be wonderful with new commentaries and illuminations and all of that, and it's going to cost you less. He promises the world. And we talked about his cutthroat competition of Bamberg, where he takes advantage of Bamberg's work to compete with him. He will reprint that which Bamberg has already printed with some mild adjustments, or he'll compete with him so that when Bamberg publishes in a particular genre, he goes and finds a manuscript that somebody else had written of the same genre in order to undercut him and compete with him, such that by the year 1548, 1549, he has put Bamberg out of business. And he enjoys a de facto monopoly of Hebrew printing in Venice because, as we said last time, the Jews were not allowed to print at this stage. The church has blocked them from printing after the Jews had excelled in the early days of the printing press. So into this scene, we introduce Rabbi Meir Katzenellenbogen, also known as Rabbi Meir of Padua. And Padua is much easier to say than Katzenelnbogen. But Katzenelnbogen kind of flows off your tongue, you know? It's just, it's very smooth. It's kind of, it's like Torchiner. It's one of those names like Schwartz and Pearl that has a ring to it. So, Rabbi Meir of Padua, Meir ben Yitzchak, is a leading rabbinical authority and scholar of Jewish law, born in Katzenelnbogen, Germany, in 1473. He studies in Prague. By the way, none of the places and dates will be on the final, not to worry. He studies in Prague. He moves to Padua, which is in Venice. It's a seat of secular learning and a seat of Jewish learning. Students come there from all over Europe. So Rabbi Meir of Padua, his father-in-law, Avram Mintz, is the chief rabbi of Padua. And in 1525, Rabbi Meir succeeds him. So he becomes the head of the rabbinical court of the Republic of Venice. He is the head of the regional council of rabbis. He is the head of the renowned yeshiva, the Academy of Padua, all until his death in the year 1565. And he seeks to publish a new edition of a text called Mishneh Torah. And I need to explain what Mishneh Torah was and just how important it is in Judaism. This is Maimonides' work of law, and you could argue that it was what he considered his major contribution to Judaism. He contributed in a whole host of ways. He wrote a commentary to the Mishnah. He wrote works of philosophy. But his Mishneh Torah is really a thing unto itself. Before Maimonides' day, before the 12th century Common Era, Jewish law texts tended to be not codes of law, where you look up section 300, law number 12A, or whatever it is. They weren't done that way. But instead, rabbis had gone through the Talmud, taken passages of it that were related to law, annotated them a little bit, and published them. So imagine that, I mean, for those who haven't studied Talmud before, imagine that you have books and books and books of debate between figures and stories and history and textual analysis. And somebody wants to tell you, well, here are the laws that emerge from that text. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take this piece from page 100 to page 120, make some notes on it, and then attach it to what's on page 180 to 185, and then so on and so on and so on. I'm putting all that together, and this is your work of law. It's not arranged by law. It's not arranged by category. It's remarkably difficult to use. If you're a student of the Talmud, that doesn't bother you, because this is the way you learn. But if you want to know anything about Jewish law and you don't have that kind of background, you're going to be completely lost. It's not going to be useful to you. So that there was one that goes back 300 years or so before Maimonides called the Bahag Baal Halachot Gedolot. There's another one called the Rif, named for Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, who was the author of it in Fez in he was from, well, he's not from, but he ends up in Fez in Morocco. We talked about him a little bit last year when we talked about the Almohads. But that he was actually the mentor of the father of Maimonides, of Rambam, of Maimonides. So what Maimonides does that's new and different is that he says, I'm going to collect Jewish law in an easy-to-access code with sections that are named by topic. So laws of prayer, laws of Shabbat, that kind of thing. And that within each section you have numbered chapters and you have numbered laws within the chapters. And it deals with the full gamut of Jewish law. So it deals with the laws of the temple, even though by the time Maimonides comes around they haven't had a temple for 1,000 years. He deals with the laws of the sacrifices and so on, with the anticipation that it will return and there will be sacrifices again. It deals with the laws of Shabbat, of holidays. It deals with things that don't really seem to fit into law to us. Areas of cosmology, like literally how the universe works, how the cosmos works, makes it into there as well. But for the most part, it's basically law. And he designates it as the central resource for the Jew. He writes in his introduction that you can learn this without being a Talmud scholar, and you don't need to ever open up the Talmud in order to grasp what I'm writing here. You don't need to learn the Talmud. So that in the text itself, he doesn't even include sources for his work. Meaning, throughout the work, he is deciding Talmudic disputes and presenting laws that no one has seen in writing before. But he's not giving you his reference points, so that there are commentators and commentators and commentators on commentators on Maimonides who devote their energy to try to figure out where did he get that? How did he decide that? And this work is so transformative that all later works of Jewish law build off of what he does. So that 150 years later, you have a work called The Tur, which does its own rewrite and restructure of Jewish law, but it's based on in large part on the work that Maimonides did. Based on The Tur, you get the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Everybody's building off of Maimonides. It's an incredibly important work. There were those who were very upset that he said, just look here, you don't need to learn the Talmud anymore. There were people who wanted to burn it. They were so upset at his revolution. But he won. At the end of the day, he won. You can't discuss anything in Jewish law anymore without referencing Maimonides. I'm seeing a couple of people who, I'm not sure if they want to say something or if they're talking to somebody else, but if you want to unmute yourself to comment, feel free. No? Okay. So, Rabbi Meir of Padua says, I want to bring this to press, and I want to make some corrections to earlier editions of it in the text of Maimonides and the text of the commentators around the text of Maimonides as well. And here I'll diverge for a second to also address something that someone asked me in the chat. Someone asked me in the chat, does the printed Talmud look the same as the handwritten Talmud? What were the differences in design, layout, and so on? So just to explain, originally the text of the Talmud was just the Talmud, and it was in handwritten manuscripts. However, what developed, and when I say developed, you're talking 12th century, really, was the practice of putting commentaries on the Talmudic text around it in the margins, and that such that you have text in the middle, commentaries outside. And it becomes the scribe's decision which commentaries to include. Rashi comes from a school of teachers who used to write their own commentaries to it, and their commentaries got attached to the Talmudic text, Rabbeinu Gershom, Rabbeinu Hananel, and Rashi himself, and that becomes incorporated. When you get to the age of the printing press, that becomes set in stone, so to speak, so that you find those commentaries written around the page of the Talmud. I would share my screen and show you what this actually looks like, because I have them accessible on here, but there isn't the time. We have so much that we want to get to. But with Maimonides and his Mishneh Torah, you have the same setup, where there are commentaries that are written on his text, and they become included in future editions around his text. And Rabbi Meir of Padua wants to print an edition which will have his text, Maimonides' text, and the medieval commentators with his corrections, as well as Rabbi Meir of Padua adds references to Talmudic sources and some commentary of his own. And he also includes a book written by Maimonides called Sefer HaMitzvot, which collects and discusses the 613 commandments. That's a discussion for another time we're not going to get to right now. As well as commentaries on Maimonides' Sefer HaMitzvot, his collection of the commandments. That's what Rabbi Meir of Padua has worked on. And he says, I want to bring this to press. Well, he goes to the only game in town, right? He goes to Giustiniani, Marco Antonio Giustiniani, and he says, let's work this out. I'd like you to print my manuscript. And Giustiniani and he cannot come to terms. Can't make it work. I don't know what exactly the issue was. Presumably it was how large the cut was going to be. But in the end, he goes to another printer, also not Jewish, by the name of Alvizeh Bragadin. And you can see him there in source number 2 on your sheet. Bragadin is a noble, an Italian noble, who prints Hebrew books. And in 1550, the house of Alvise Bragadin publishes Mishneh Torah using the edition of Rabbi Meir of Padua and even some financial investment from Rabbi Meir. He has to invest in his own publication. It's not self-published, but it's certainly self-funded. So, word gets to Bragadin that Justiniani is preparing a rip-off edition. Because that's what Justiniani does. So in his edition, Bragadin includes a note. And I brought it here for you in source number 3. It's my translation of his note. He says, I know that when, and I skipped a little bit for time and space reasons, but I know that when Justiniani sees this, he'll see that I've begun to publish the 24. The 24. Anybody know what the 24 is a reference to? It's not Mishneh Torah. What would the 24 be a reference to? Nope. Tanakh. The 24 books of Tanakh. So when he sees that I've begun to publish the 24 books of Tanakh, I see Chaim wrote it in the chat. Good. As well as Rav Alfas, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi's work, he too will race to the battle to do this work. And not sooner, as he did with me regarding Maimonides. He's going to do this once I have published it. That's when he's going to do it. With this I will know that you will praise me, for it is due to me that books will be available cheaply. So he says, you know what? As a result, because I did all the hard work, and now Justiniani is going to come in to undercut me, you will have books cheaply. So everybody should be grateful to me. That's what Bragadin says. He knows what's going to happen. So that's his. That's what he writes. Okay. Shortly thereafter, Justiniani indeed publishes a new edition of Mishneh Torah, of Maimonides' work. And he includes Rabbi Meir of Padua's commentary. It's in there. He rips it off. His commentary, his source references, and everything else. It's mind-blowing that he does this. But not just that. His edition is cheaper. He says, I want to help the Jewish community to buy books as cheaply as possible. And he adds insult to injury. He moves Rabbi Meir of Padua's commentary to an appendix. And then in his preface to the volume, he says, yeah, the whole thing is really worthless. Take a look at source number 4, the frontispiece of the Justiniani edition of the Mishneh Torah. And I gave you a link where you can find the Hebrew version of it on Hebrew books. We have also decided to print at the end. That at the end, meaning at the end of my book, he says, Justiniani says, I'm going to print that which was written on the page by one sage, head of the rabbis of Padua, Rabbi Meir, new each morning. That's a phrase in Hebrew, Hadashim Labekarim, from the book of Eicha, from the book of Lamentations. It's a term that he's using to say, new kid on the block. Look at this new kid on the block, Rabbi Meir. We included what he wrote. He wrote of his own heart in the Maimonidean edition, printed anew by Bragadin, introducing his head between the early giants. Look at this upstart Rabbi Meir who wrote a commentary. This new kid here who put his head between the early giants who are debating with each other. He puts himself into this. We consulted wise and complete people near and far, and in truth, they counseled us not to print them in this book, lest they not appear correct to many students of Torah. We're afraid that by including his comments, we're going to mislead people. They're going to think that there's substance to them. But he says they can't be seen as clear, as valuable, as clear to any who examines one preface on the other side of this page. He says anybody who looks at Rabbi Meir's work is going to realize that he's got a lot of mistakes in it. This is no good. I thought about, not including it, because it can mislead people. But why is it here? But in truth, we printed them to satisfy the desire of every man. He quotes in the book of Esther, doing the will of each man. Just like at the party in the beginning of the book of Esther, everybody has whatever they want to drink. So too, I put it in my book, because there's no accounting for taste. Somebody may want to read Rabbi Meir of Padua's work, even though it's completely worthless. Clear? Okay. So that's what he does. He includes it, without permission, of course. And he says, the scholars have told me it's worthless, but fine, I stuck it in here. that's what he does. And there's more, but you get the sense of the flavor of what's going on here. So now what happens? Now what are you going to do if you are Rabbi Meir Katzen Ellenbogen, who not only has been insulted, but more to the point, you're being crushed financially. You just put up money for the printing of an edition, and now a competing edition is being published. It's going to be cheaper. No one's going to buy yours. So what he does is he argues the case on copyright grounds. Now, logically, legally, there should be no such thing as copyright. Right? And when you think about it, what should stop me from reading somebody's book and sitting there with a pen and paper and copying it and then selling it? What should stop me from hearing a song that somebody sings and then recording it myself and selling it? I haven't taken any physical object from anyone. Where is the legal problem with stealing somebody's intellectual property, whether in Judaism or in general? So Albert Kirshen writes in the chat, Masig Gevul. Masig Gevul, overstepping the boundary. Illegal competition. Maybe. We're going to talk about that, but that's not an issue of theft. That's an issue of competing in a way that we don't like. And that you'd have to really think about, how exactly does that become illegal competition? By what right is it illegal competition? If you take a look at source number 5, this is from the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is alive while all of this is going on, but living in Israel, in Tzfat, he says, one may transfer through sale or gift only items of substance. Intangible items may not be transferred. There's no such thing as intangible property. You can't buy it, you can't sell it. If you can't touch it, it doesn't have substance. Literally, it doesn't have substance. And in secular law also, at this stage, there is no copyright protection. What is secular copyright law based on? What's the first established statute that gets quoted when you deal with copyright law? The Statute of Anne in England in 1709. It's not till 1709 that you have secular copyright law. And it's based on a few points. And because we're short on time, I'm going to state them instead of asking you to suggest them. It's based on the following principles. Number one, the idea that an author owns the right to the fruits of the author's labor. Not that something has been taken, but rather that if I worked on it, I have the right to benefit from it. You can't benefit from it using the benefit that I would have received. That's a little flimsy. Someone writes to me in the chat, maybe it's Genevas Das. Genevas Das means deception. You fool someone into thinking you wrote it. And that may be true, but it's not a tort. And especially here, he didn't even fool anybody into thinking he did it. Justiniani is very explicit that he's not claiming credit for it. He says, I'm writing what somebody else did. Printing what somebody else did. But one approach is to say the author owns the rights to the fruits of the author's labor. Another approach is to say, you're right, it's not theft, but it's in the best interests of the state to grant rights to creators. Because this is how you'll have an advancement of learning. Meaning, in the event that creators aren't going to be protected, they're going to stop creating. Right? Why would I work on publishing a book? Why would I work on publishing a song if anybody can simply take it? Another argument that's used is that copyright is trade regulation. Along the lines of what Dr. Kirshen had said in the chat, it's about fair competition. We want to make sure that there aren't going to be fights within society. Another argument for copyright is that it's not actually economic at all, but rather the creation is an extension and continuing expression of the author. It's like part of the author's body. Whatever I create is part of me. Right, tell that to my teenage children. But that's the idea, at any rate, that whatever I create is part of me, and therefore I have some element of ownership. So those are all secular arguments that are brought to support copyright protection. But none of that has been dealt with at this point in history. We are about 160 years too early for the statute of Anne, not to mention in the wrong country. So what's going to happen when Rabbi Meir of Padua is dealing with this problem? So there was a rabbi who I listed at the end of the list in source number 2. A rabbi at this time named Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Rabbi Moshe Isserles was born in either the year 1520 or 1530. I've seen both. Presumably the answer was only one of them, but I don't know which one. Either way, he was very young at the time when this happened in the year 1550. Right? You could do the math. He's 20 or 30 years old. He has just been appointed the rabbi of Krakow, major city in Poland. He is on his way to becoming the leading Ashkenazi authority in Jewish law of his day. He wrote what would become the Ashkenazi portion of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Before that, he wrote something called the Darkei Moshe, which was a commentary on an earlier Code of Jewish Law called the Tur. He wrote major philosophical and mystical works as well, called Torat HaOlah. And he wrote Responsa, which are still consulted to this day. So Rabbi Meir of Padua goes to Rabbi Moshe Isserles and says, help. But he has another reason to go to Rabbi Moshe Isserles. First of all, Rabbi Isserles and he were like-minded. They were leading proponents of rationalism, the rationalism of Maimonides. They were both committed to the study of science. They both supported the idea of codifying Jewish law in codes like that of Maimonides, while others were still opposed to that. Oh, and by the way, they were second cousins once removed. So there's that also. So that's where we go. You shouldn't be surprised by that. Ashkenazi Jewry at this stage, you know, if you've ever heard those studies that they've done with mitochondrial DNA trying to trace Ashkenazim, and they tell you it goes back to 4 or 5 women in the time of the Crusades in Germany. So there's some debate about those findings, but it's true that everybody was really, it was like Toronto, just a little bit more spread out. Like everybody was related to everybody else. So they're second cousins once removed. So Rabbi Isserles gives a ruling on this case. And just give you an overview of how he approached it. He says, Rabbi Meir of Padua is right, but only in a limited way. He says, Rabbi Meir of Padua will receive an exclusive right to sell out his already printed edition before anybody can purchase the Justiniani edition of Mishneh Torah. Why? Because, he says, Rabbi Meir of Padua is entitled to prevent Justiniani and other competitors from undermining his chance of recovering the investment that he made. However, Rabbi Isserles believed that the author / editor of a work has no enduring proprietary right in the product. His argument is not based on a proprietary right. And now we'll see what his argument is. First point that he makes is, he understands that he's issuing a ruling in a competition that is really between two non-Jewish printers. Right? How is he going to force the non-Jewish printers to comply? He says, no, Justiniani, you can't sell off your edition. Justiniani says, thank you very much, Jew. Go back to your ghetto. Like, where does this, you know, how does this actually work? But he says, from a Jewish law perspective, they are supposed to follow us. And therefore, Jews doing business with them is going to need, you know, like buying the book is going to need to follow it. He says the Noahides are theoretically subject to the 7 Noahide laws, the laws that apply to all human beings. And so he says that should indeed be enough to compel them to comply. And certainly, if they were to come to us for judgment, we would judge them according to Jewish law. So if you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Isserles writes, in the beginning of his response, he says, we will not abandon our part. We declare that all Israel, and anyone known as Israel, should not purchase any new copy of Maimonides other than those which emerge from the hand of the aforementioned Gaon. Gaon being a term for somebody who in this era is simply a great rabbi, Gaonim earlier were the heads of the academies of Torah, but not at this stage in history. He just means the aforementioned great rabbi, or those whom he has empowered for the following four reasons. He says, no one should buy in a new copy, only what Rabbi Meir of Padua has funded, for four reasons. His first reason is unfair competition. That's his first concern, what Dr. Kirshen floated before. If you take a look at source number 7, you find where this comes from. It's a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud here is talking about competition, and specifically along a street. And the type of street we're talking about here, you have to know a little bit about the urban planning of Talmudic times. You had major roads, and then off of the major road, you would have a side street, which is what I called an alley here, and had a closed end. So that the only traffic in and out of this alley is coming out of that entrance at the beginning of the alley. And then off of this alley, off of the side street, you had yards, and there were houses off of those yards. Okay, can you picture this? You've got your main drag, main street, and then off of that you've got your side street, and off of that you've got houses, but the side street doesn't go anywhere else. So, Rav Huna said in source number 7, and I just put the link for the source sheet in the chat again for those who have just joined. If a resident of a side street establishes a mill, and another resident establishes one nearer to the sole entrance to the alley, to the side street. You follow? So now everybody who enters is going to go to the other one first. The former is legally able to prevent this, saying, you are interrupting my livelihood. You're not allowed to compete with me. That's Rav Huna's statement. And it's not only Rav Huna's statement, because I brought you a later authority from the 13th century in Germany who brings you this case. He says, where a street is closed on three sides, and only on one side is it open for entry. And Reuven, anonymous person, Reuven, now he's anonymous, lives near the closed end. And Shimon comes to live near the open end, such that a non-Jew could not enter the street without passing Shimon's entrance. The law is that Reuven can prevent this new business, like the view of Rav Huna. Okay? In order to get trade from people who don't know you and have no relationship with you, you need to be closest to the front of the alley. So if somebody else moves in closer to the front, now you're going to be in trouble. So therefore, Rav Huna's position is that's an inappropriate competition. And Rabbi Isserles ruled that even though that's actually controversial, not everybody agrees with Rav Huna's position, he says everybody would agree in the case where it is clear cut that your commercial activity is going to destroy somebody else's business, that you're not allowed to compete that way. That's argument number one. So it's not an argument about proprietary rights, it's an argument about competition. His second argument is, it's really important to support these kinds of creators. Just like we said in the Statute of Anne, you want to make sure that there will be creators, so to here, we want to make sure that there will be scholarship in Jewish law. Otherwise, it's going to stagnate. So if you take a look at source number 9, you find another passage from the Talmud in which Rav Dimi of Neherda brought dried figs by boat. He wanted to sell them. And the exilarch, the leader of the Jewish community in Babylon, said to the sage, Rava, go see. If he's a young scholar, set up the market for him. Try to make sure he will have a place to sell his figs. We need to support what is essentially the R&D division of Judaism. We need research and development. So we need to make sure that he's going to be able to do business and sell off his figs. And the same thing is true here. Now, this actually is a little bit controversial, because we're taught in Pirkei Avot that you're not supposed to make use of the crown of Torah for yourself. You're not supposed to say that you are due something special because you are a Torah scholar. That's true, but where people need to do business anyway, and they have a choice about whom they're going to do business with, it's valuable for it to go to this person who is giving back to the community in this way. There's more to be said. Maimonides has an interesting discussion about this actually as well. But that's the second argument of Rabbi Isserles. First of all, unfair competition. Second, we need to support these kinds of creators. Third, he says, Justiniani is a Christian publisher. Rabbi Meir of Padua is Jewish, and he says he's family. You need to support your family. And he quotes a midrash like this in source number 10. I'm not going to read the midrash aloud, just in the interests of time. But he says, it's really important that we support our family members, and therefore people should be buying from Rabbi Meir of Padua, and even if it means that they suffer a small loss, they have to pay a little bit more, you support family first. And then finally, he says, Rabbi Meir of Padua is a scholar. His work is going to be error-checked really, really well. And it's critical that our Torah texts be accurate. So he says, better to get the work from Rabbi Meir of Padua, which is going to be more accurate. And then he says, don't tell me that if you don't buy Justiniani's work, he's going to hate us and it's going to cause problems for us. You can just tell him, I don't want to buy right now. He says, don't worry about it. So that's Rabbi Moshe Isserles' position. But he only protects the right until that run sells out. He doesn't say it's an infinite right. He says only to allow Rabbi Meir of Padua to recoup his investment. And there's a lot of discussion in Jewish law as to why the right is so limited. But I want to talk about the results of this remarkable story. First of all, just to know, Justiniani stops printing this work, and the House of Bragadin actually emerges to dominate Hebrew printing in Venice until well into the 18th century. So Bragadin wins. That's number one. Number two, though, before Bragadin wins, this leads to the burning of the Talmud in Italy. You see, Bragadin, as I mentioned before, tries to print an edition of the Talmud in 1551. Justiniani has it in for Bragadin at this point, and he hires Jews who had converted to Christianity to go to Rome and to tell Pope Julius III bad things about the Talmud, like we talked about when we discussed censorship, in order to get him to block Bragadin from printing his edition. So Bragadin says, ha, I'll get you. He hires a Jew who has converted to Christianity to go to Rome and complain about Justiniani's edition, which actually beat him to the press. Pope Julius III hires Cardinal Carafa. Cardinal Carafa would go on to become Pope Paul IV, the one who created the index that we talked about when we talked about censorship. He assigns Cardinal Carafa to investigate the Talmud. And the investigation leads, ultimately, to a public burning of the Talmud and a ban on printing Jewish books in Venice that lasts until 1564, blocking some of Bragadin's work. So, you know, the classic line, which I think it was, I forget who it was who said it at the time of the phalangist business in Lebanon, that one non-Jew is fighting with another non-Jew, and the Jews are the ones who are going to suffer for it. So that's exactly what happens here. It's Bragadin versus Justiniani, and the Talmud gets burned. But there are other remarkable results of these publishing wars. First of all, Rabbi Isserles' position protecting intellectual property becomes standard in Judaism. So that there were fights about prints of the Heidenheim Machzor, going back to the beginning of the 19th century. And Rabbi Isserles' point was cited, his position was cited regarding unfair competition. So his position becomes very important in the development of Jewish law, and down till today. Because the issue, which has been such a big issue over the last 20, 30 years, downloading movies and MP3s, all of that, all traces back to Rabbi Isserles' conversation. Also, the growth of what we called last week the Haskama, or 2 weeks ago, the Haskama, the note in the beginning of a text, which started out as a statement that the book was cleared from censorship, now became a statement of, this author has the sole right to print this text. But also, because of the burning and the bans that happened with the Talmud, and that happened with Maimonides' work of law, a new work of law comes to dominate. It's called the Beit Yosef. Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote a commentary to the Tur, a code of Jewish law, and it gains primacy in part Because people don't have copies of the Talmud, and people don't have copies of Maimonides. And that Beit Yosef becomes the basis for the Shulchan Aruch, for the code of Jewish law. So a lot of different impacts emerge from this bizarre copyright battle. I would love to pause here for questions, but what I'm going to do instead, noting we have 20 minutes left, is I'm going to take the time to discuss a forgery, like I said we would.